good morning, everyone. It's morning where I am. I don't know about you because I just woke up a few minutes ago. This is John St. Germain with Crystal Silence League Hour, and I do hope that you're having a good, good day. I spoke to a woman this morning, and she said, any day I wake up above ground is a good day, and man, I agree with that. Well, tonight is March 29th, 2016. We're almost through with March and about to start April. Man, how I wish a show would fall on April Fool's Day. I was really hoping that would happen because I would have a really good time with that. But it didn't, so here we are in March 29th. And tonight's show we're going to talk about, we're still talking about the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha. Tonight we're going to look at right livelihood, and we're still looking at right action. So we're going to talk about sexual misconduct, and isn't that a fun topic? And also right livelihood. So by all means, my goodness, stay with us and come back in just a minute, would you? I'm back. I hope you are too. Some people have sent emails sometimes and said, what is that opening music you play? Well, that's Facades by Philip Glass. It's from his album Glassworks, and I'm a big fan of Philip Glass. And my son and I took a journey one time to the Metropolitan Opera to see a Philip Glass opera called Satyagraha, which is an opera about Gandhi. And it was really important because Satyagraha premiered the year my son was born, 1980. And he grew up listening to it, among other music. And Philip Glass himself was there, and he came out and took a bow. And my son and I were in the second row from right behind the conductor, who was Fabio Luzzi, who is the the head of the music department, music head, I guess, of the Metropolitan Opera, since James Levine is semi-retired. And I know most of you are saying, well, who gives a shit about any of that, John? But, you know, it's kind of important to me. It was a spirit quest, me and my son. You know, we took that. And you know, visited a bunch of my friends in New York, and you know, shout outs to my guys in New York if you're listening to the show. And Philip Glass came out and took a bow, and my son and I were like, thanks for making music for crazy people like us, you know, because if you listen to Philip Glass, you know, it's sometimes called minimalism, and it's musical themes that are repeated over and 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 over. There's a joke, knock knock, who's there? Philip Glass, Philip Glass, Philip Glass, Philip Glass, Philip Glass, Philip Glass, Philip Glass. Gosh, it's good to be here. I feel really good tonight. We're all going to talk about the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha and right livelihood, and that gives me a chance to talk about finances and money and stuff too, which is an important topic. But first, let's talk about watermelon tourmaline, our crystal of the week. I want to have a an introduction to that says crystal of the week, which I think would be kind of cool. Watermelon tourmaline, as you see in our picture, looks like watermelon. It has a red interior, a white rim, and a green exterior. It's a marvelous crystal. Not cheap. You can get a fairly good-sized piece of it, about the size of anywhere between a quarter and a half dollar, between $50 and $90. I'm serious. It's not cheap, but it's a wonderful stone. It resonates being pinkish and greenish to the heart chakra. So it opens, balances, and harmonizes the heart chakra. It heals those past love aches that you might have, helps lay those to rest. But furthermore, it's very interesting in terms of attracting both love and prosperity, being both reddish pink and green. So it's used a lot in spells involving fast luck and fast money, wealth, prosperity, and love. It's like an all-purpose attraction stone. So it's well worth the investment. And there's a premise in finances that you have to spend money to make money. So I think when you buy your crystals, sometimes it's not a bad idea to invest in a good piece. I know I've been at psychic fairs and people would come by and say, oh, so what can I get for $5? You know, how many crystals can I buy for $5? You know, what's your cheapest crystals here? That's kind of like shopping for the cheapest airline. You know, what's the cheapest airline that I have? You know, here's Air Jamaica. Let's fly on Air Jamaica. You can fly anywhere on Air Jamaica. They don't have a black box. They have a black bag. They write a note on it that says, "We crashed," and throw it out the window. No thanks. I don't want that. The Crystal Silence League, for those of you who may be new listeners, was founded in 1917 by Mr. Claude Alexander Conlin, who's a remarkable man, and you can read more about him on the Crystal Silence League website, www.crystalsilenceleague.org, for the purpose of distributing and projecting and disseminating positive affirmations and prayers for all those in need of those things. And when he passed into the silence himself around 1954, which is 6 years before I was born, by the way, he took it with him. Well, adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church, which you can also find online, brought it back to life in cybernetic form a few years ago, and we now post prayers online. And you can go to our prayer site and post prayers, and prayers are always free at the Crystal Silence League. And you can also buy crystal balls and learn and purchase a few books, very cheap, or get a free book if you buy a crystal on how to learn the four branches of crystal gazing, which of course are attraction and projection and healing and seership. And learning these things, you can also learn mediumship with a crystal ball, and we discuss that on this show. And we also have a newsletter, a free newsletter, which I edit, and you can subscribe to. And I apologize to those who subscribe that we're often late, but the March newsletter is ready, and we're proofreading it. My able proofreaders, the Ironwoods, Nagashiva, and Catherine, are proofreading it, and we will send that out as soon as they give me the green light, hopefully by the end of the month, which is we have a couple days left in this month, don't we? Yeah, we have a couple days left. We may get it out on time. And this month, by the way, in the newsletter, we have surviving astrological bad weather with the help of crystals, and such as Venus and Mercury retrogrades. And we do have a big Mercury retrograde coming up in April, so that you may find this of interest. We do not have Venus retrogrades in 2016, by the way, so you don't have to worry about Venus retrogrades kicking you in the rear end. So it is our custom in the Crystal Silence League that whenever there's hundreds of prayers posted every week, I print out a whole bunch of them. That was my cat knocking over something, by the way. He found his way into my office. That's Figaro, the ethereal cat, and he often comes into my office and knocks stuff over. And in the Crystal Silence League, we print out many of these prayers, and I read those aloud online. And so tonight I will do so, and I invite all of you to pray along with me. Often we have people call in, and they will call in and ask us to pray for them. And believe me, if you want to do that, by all means, do so. Our number, if you want to call in and talk to us, by the way, if you want to call and talk to me, this is a live show, unless you're listening to it on podcast, in which case it won't do you any good to call in, because you can't talk to a recording. Well, you can call in and talk to a recording if you want, but we won't talk back. But right now, if you're listening, the host calling number is 213-325-3434, and you press 1. And a little flag will pop up, and I'll bring you on the air if you need us to pray for you or you just want to talk about things. But let us read some of the prayers, and I will not say these out loud. These are anonymous, and I'll just identify them not by name, but by prayer number. So read some of these prayers out loud. We'll just read a few of them. If I read all hundreds of these prayers we get, it'd be dysfunctional. So prayer ID number 49226, who just had a home business fail, apparently, and they're trying to find jobs. She and her husband are trying to find jobs, so she prays that, you know, may she and her husband find good, satisfying jobs and be on the same page with the finances and get back on top. So may that happen. And that prayer went on today. So prayer ID number 49225 is looking, this young lady is looking for a way to balance writing and making music and finding her way to the man who will become the greatest love she has ever known. She wants every aspect of her life to come together. There's nothing wrong with that. Prayer ID number 49222, who needs steady work and hopes to get the job that he has applied for. So please let that happen. We have prayer ID number 49221, needs his prayer to be heard, who's waiting on child support, income tax, and boss's dated check to be okay to cash. This is a woman who is in dire need of money. And we have a prayer of gratitude, 49224, who's thanking all the little things we take for granted, the pretty flowers, the blue sky, and even the ability to set our favorite Italian folk songs in the 50s to ringtones on our cell phone. This is a person overflowing with gratitude. Gosh, isn't that just nice? To have something like that happen, that is just wonderful. And we have prayer ID number 49219. This person prays for heavy protection surrounding that person and that divine miracles unfold in his or her life. We have prayer ID number 49218, who prays to have stolen items returned that were stolen from his car. We have prayer ID number 49217, who prays that angels will protect this person, which is apparently this is someone who is beset by dark forces and negativity and needs protection from this this type of prayer. And my goodness, that's always bad. I'm looking at it's always bad when you see something like that. We have prayer ID number 49211. I was looking at that because the way it's phrased seems to me that there's something really bad going on. Prayer ID number 49211. Prays to be able to hear God's will for this person. And prayer ID number 49208. Prays to have all negative influences around money removed so that the flow of prosperity can enter this woman's life. And prayer ID number 49207. Prays for a better situation in her living arrangement. And we have prayer ID number 49212. Prays that medical insurance and senior apartment application be approved in Jesus' name. These are our prayers tonight. So let us please pray for these people that they get the prayers answered, and let's take just a moment of silence and pray for all those in need of prayer and comfort and succor. Om Shanti Shanti. Well, tonight we're talking about the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha, and this is a topic I'm really enjoying, and I hope you are too. I have been talking to people about Buddhism, the Eightfold Noble Path, for as long as I can remember. My entire adult life, I discovered Buddhism in high school, and it was like coming home to me. And I was raised in the Baptist church, and I came to Buddhism as a very young man, and I found no conflict with it, really, in that Buddhism teaches an ethical path, and it teaches you to be moral and to be empathetic and to be compassionate. Some of the fine-tuning of it is a little different, but not contradictory. And we're looking at right action this week, which is the moral and ethical training of the Eightfold Path. It's the triad. And we looked at right action, and we looked at right speech, and we talked about that. And this week we're looking at the second part of right action, which is abstaining from sexual misconduct. We looked at abstaining from taking that which is not given last week, which is not only stealing, but also deceiving and fraudulent actions and things like that. And now we're looking at sexual misconduct. And so, in the words of the Buddha, he avoids sexual misconduct and abstains from it. He has no intercourse with such persons as are still under the protection of father, mother, brother, sister, or relatives, nor with married women, nor with female convicts, nor lastly with betrothed girls. Now, the inverse of this is true as well. You would say she avoids sexual misconduct and abstains from it. She has no intercourse with such persons that are still under the protection of mother, father, brother, sister, or relatives, nor with married men, nor with male convicts, nor lastly with betrothed men. And the guiding purpose of this precept, from the ethical standpoint, are to protect marital relations from outside disruption and to promote trust and fidelity within the marital union. In other words, infidelity is a no-no. So from the spiritual standpoint, it helps curb the tendency of sexual desire to go out of control. And thus, it's a step in the direction of renunciation, which reaches its ultimate expression in the observance of celibacy. And yes, there are very devout Buddhist married couples who do practice celibacy within their marriage. But the expression of celibacy is most often assumed to be binding on monks and nuns who take vows. But for lay people, the precept enjoins abstaining from sexual relations with an illicit partner. And the primary transgression is entering into full sexual union, but all other sexual involvements of a less complete kind may be considered secondary infringements. What this means is that for a monk, masturbation is a secondary infringement. So the main question raised by the precept concerns who is to count as an illicit partner. The Buddha statement defines the illicit partner from the perspective of the man, but later on, the treatises, all the later writings, elaborate the matter for both sexes. So for a man, specifically, three kinds of women are considered off limits. A woman who is married to another man, and this includes beside a woman already married to a man, a woman who is not his legal wife, but is generally recognized as his consort, who lives with him or is kept by him or is in some way acknowledged as his partner. So, no, you can't sleep with another guy's girlfriend. That's a no-no as well. Hitting on another man's woman is just considered wrong. And, you know, that happens to me a lot. My girlfriend is really, you know, I call her my wife because we live together. And, you know, we live together and we're raising a kid. But, you know, we're not married on paper. Because both of us had really bad marriages, and we can't even talk. We say, should we get, we can't even say the word married, but, you know, we live together as husband and wife. We just don't have a paper, but, you know, we call each other husband and wife. But what the hell, we do whatever we want. We're in our 50s. But people will hit on her in front of me. And, you know, how weak and sad is it to hit on another man's woman? You know, how weak and sad is it for a woman to hit on another man's, you know, another woman's man? You know, it's weak and it's sad. I said, you know, she's with me. How weak and sad are you to hit on another man? There's plenty of single women. You know, what is it with you, man? But all these women are considered illicit partners because, you know, for men other than their own husbands or boyfriends. And we're talking about heterosexual relationships, but the same applies to same sex. You don't hit on another person's partner. A woman who is still under protection, and this is a girl who is under the protection of her mother, father, relatives, or others rightfully entitled to be their guardians. We're talking about, in our society, minors. And this rules out elopements or secret marriages contrary to the wishes of the protecting party. If someone is still under the protection of their parents, you don't break that covenant. A woman prohibited by convention, and this includes close female relatives, incest, forbidden by partners by social tradition, nuns and other women under a vow of celibacy, and those prohibited as partners by the law of the land. I can't give you examples of that, but, you know, there are certain social restrictions that, you know, you're not allowed to marry. First cousins in some societies. Now, in Tennessee, first cousins can marry. That's not illegal. First and second cousins can marry. The lines of consanguinity are not that restrictive. From the standpoint of a woman, two kinds of men are considered illicit partners. For a married woman, any kind of man other than her husband is out of bounds. Thus, a married woman violates the precept if she breaks the vow of fidelity to her husband. But a widow or divorcee is free to remarry. Now, in Buddha's time, this was huge. In Buddha's time in India, this was huge because to this day, a widow or divorcee is frowned upon in India. For a woman, any man is forbidden by convention, such as close relatives and those under a vow of celibacy. It's an illicit partner. So any case of forced, violent, or coercive sexual union constitutes a transgression. But in such a case, the violation falls only on the offender, not on the one compelled to submit. Forced, violent, or coercive sexual intercourse is a transgression, but it only falls on the offender, not on the victim. Often, you'll hear people say they don't like Buddhism because the victim is blamed. This step, these words of the Buddha, utterly contradicts that. The victim is not blamed, only the transgressor in these precepts. So the positive virtue corresponding to this this abstinence for lay people, is marital fidelity. Abstinence in sexual morality for lay people is marital fidelity. It's abstaining from sexual misconduct. That's what abstinence means for lay people. It's okay to have sex with your husband or wife. That is abstinence. And you will hear on a lot of Buddhist forums, people disagree with that. I got into a disagreement with a moderator on Dhamma Wheel about that because he went on about how orgasm was a lustful thing, and I said there's more to lovemaking with your wife than orgasm, and he PM'd me and said I was condescending and rude, and I said I think maybe you're a very young man. I said when you get to 50, you understand that there's more to making love to a woman than orgasm, and I said and maybe that's why you're not married or you don't have a girlfriend or you're abstaining, but and I'm sorry if you see that as condescending. I said but you can be a Buddhist and you can practice abstinence and still make love to your wife if you understand the precepts. Marital fidelity is, and marital fidelity doesn't mean you have to be married. It means that you're in a committed relationship. That is fidelity to a layman. So ordained monks and nuns, including men and women who have undertaken the 8 or 10 precepts, and that's the upasakas, people would take the lay vows, and I lived like that for about 5 years. I was an upasaka. I took the 10 vows. Are obliged to observe utter celibacy, no sex, no masturbation, no sex. So you abstain not only from sexual misconduct, but from all sexual involvements, at least during the period of your vows. And I'm going to tell you that during Visakha, the Buddhist, basically it's the Buddhist holiday, the Buddhist Christmas, the birthday of the Buddha, which is in May. It's close to my birthday, by the way. You often will practice the monks for that weekend, or that even that week, you'll practice the monk's vows. You'll abstain from eating before afternoon, and you'll practice celibacy and things like that. So because the holy life, in its highest expression, aims at complete purity in thought, word, and deed, and this requires turning back that high tide, you know, that the tidal wave of sexual desire. So what I want to go talk about now, you know, that's enough. I mean, we know what sexual conduct is. It's common sense, you know, man. Don't cheat on your partner, and don't sleep with another man's woman or man, and don't rape, and don't trick someone into having sex with you. You know, don't say things you don't mean. Don't smooth talk a man or a woman and just to sleep with them and then dump them because don't be a douchebag. Don't be a douchebag. And you know, if you're going to make love to somebody, I don't think this one night stand thing is harmless. You know, having casual sex, I don't think casual sex is harmless. It's exploitive, and I consider, you know, one night stands, even if it's mutually agreed, casual sex, even if it's mutually agreed, I think it's borderline sexual misconduct. You may disagree with me. You know, you say, who's hurt? I think you hurt yourself. And as you get older, as you become more spiritually aware, I think you'll agree with me. Let's go to right livelihood. This is a precept that ensures, is concerned, and ensures you're living in a righteous way. Now, as a monk, that's no problem, but as a lay disciple, the Buddha teaches that wealth should be gained in accordance with certain standards. Buddha has no problem with you being wealthy. You can be as rich as God, no problem with that, as long as it's righteous. You should acquire it by legal means, not illegally. You should acquire it peacefully, without coercion or violence. You should acquire it honestly, not by trickery or deceit. And you should acquire it in a way which does not entail harm or suffering for others. Now, the Buddha mentions five specific kinds of livelihood which bring harm to others and are therefore to be avoided: dealing in weapons, in living beings, which includes raising animals for slaughter, as well as slave trade and prostitution; in meat production and butchery; in poisons and in intoxicants, and that is selling drugs and selling alcohol. He further names several dishonest means of gaining wealth which fall under wrong livelihood: practicing deceit, treachery, unfortunately soothsaying, trickery, and usury. Now, obviously, any occupation that requires violation of right speech and right action is a wrong form of livelihood, but other occupations, such as selling weapons or intoxicants, may not violate those factors and yet be wrong because of their consequences or others. Now, the dishonest means of gaining wealth, which fall under wrong livelihood, such as soothsaying, only apply to monks, not to laymen. Those practices of fortune-telling and soothsaying are never mentioned in conjunction with laymen. That used to be brought up in conjunction with me when I was a moderator on E-Sangha. They would say, well, how do you justify being a Buddhist and a psychic reader? And I said, that only applies to monks, man. It doesn't say that. That's in some of the restrictions where he talks to the monks. He said there are certain contemplatives and bhikkhus who make a living by reading marks and soothsaying, and he said this is not right livelihood for a monk. He never talks about in terms of laymen. Monks are not supposed to do that because monks are supposed to promulgate a faith in the Dharma. And but as for laymen, we walk a thin line there, because if you are a soothsayer, it is awfully easy to take advantage of people. And so it's a very fine line. And you can easily go into wrong profession if you're a fortune teller. That's the danger. Some other professions that are very close are, believe it or not, entertainment. Acting and entertainment is, there's a suspicious eye in Buddhism. He talks a lot of times about entertainers and actors and singers, dancers, things like that. Theater is considered borderline entertainment, where you must be very careful. But you understand that in Buddhism, intention is very important. So the whole idea, are you harming others? Are you practicing deception and trickery? And, you know, in a lot of people's eyes, you know, if you're a fortune teller, you know, you're a con artist. You know, you're practicing deception. That's just bottom line. So, because there are so many people that do, and unfortunately, many of the people that do become high profile. They're the ones you hear about, and so you have to be very, very careful about that. But it's nuanced. In Buddhism, it's nuanced. Not all soothsayers and fortune tellers practice wrong livelihood. It's just don't practice wrong livelihood if you are a fortune teller. So you can gain wealth. You can become wealthy. And many of Buddha's most prominent disciples in the suttas in the literature were wealthy people. They would support the Sangha. They gave gifts, and they provided food, they provided shelter, they gave them robes. When I say they gave gifts, they gave them robes. They supported them this way. And on that topic, I wanted to talk a little bit about finance, because there are a lot of people who think that money is evil or wrong. And often if you're in my profession, where you are a spiritual advisor, people will ask you to do free readings. They'll ask you to do free consultation, and you look into it, and they have money. Obviously, they have money, and they but they don't want to pay for a reading, or they'll ask you for a free reading as a sample. Do you give a sample reading? And I'd say no, I don't. I said I don't really have anything to prove. I'm well established in this business, and they say, well, I don't understand, if you're a spiritual worker, why you charge for it. And well, this is my business. I'm also a businessman, and I do accounting. I keep my own books. I know where my money comes and goes, and I sell things. I write books. I have book royalties. I have about 7 sources of income, and I'm incorporated. I'm a businessman as well as everything else, and people think that's not spiritual. That's not spiritual. Well, it is, and it depends on how you do it. Again, no harm. Do no harm. Don't take advantage. Do no harm. And The thing is this, I know everyone, I look on Facebook and I see people complaining and bitching about rich people, these rich devils, these rich people, and I'm going to tell you that you don't have to be Nostradamus to predict this or to say this. All you have to do is read the posts or talk to the people. About 80% of the people who bitch about rich people are going out and buying scratch-off lottery tickets. And isn't that funny? A lot of these people that bitch about rich people, most of them are going out and buying Powerball tickets. And if they hit the jackpot, I ask these people, so if you hit the jackpot, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to buy a house. I'm going to buy this. I'm going to buy that. And that is greed-based desire. Spending money and buying stuff is greed. All these greedy rich people, all they do, they just think about money. Well, you're going to get $1 billion and you're going to go buy stuff. That too is greed. And there's another subtle form of greed where you people say, well, I'll buy my kids houses, I'll buy my mom a house, I'll buy people cars. Buying stuff for other people is greed too. It's just a more subtle type of greed. It's the thrill of buying and acquisition. And you want to know the difference between rich people and poor people? I want to give it to you in a nutshell. Poor people spend money. Rich people invest money. It's simple as that. And the thing is, the same thing. You're spending money. You're buying stuff. But poor people buy things. Rich people buy assets. Assets are whatever put money in your pocket. Poor people buy stuff that takes money out of their pocket. And that is the difference. If you have money and you don't have to have a lot, if you have $100 and you buy an asset that puts money in your pocket, and you keep doing this, you'll be rich. And this is the secret to it. And I'm going to tell you this. Being poor is a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle decision. And if you blame outside forces for that, if you say it's the man keeping me down, it's fate, it's luck, you're always going to be poor. Being broke is temporary. Being poor is permanent because it's a lifestyle. And there's nothing wrong with being broke. There's nothing wrong with being poor. But understand there's a difference. I've been broke several times. I've never been poor. I've always been prosperous. I've not had a penny in my pocket sometimes, but I've been prosperous because I know that's temporary, and I know I'm going to, tomorrow I will have money in my pocket, because I've never said, my God, I'm poor. Poor means that if I get a dollar, I'm going to spend it. Prosperous means if I get a dollar, I'm going to use it to invest in my business. I'm going to invest it in making more money. Now, that's the difference. And, what the Buddha has said about money is that and he advised a young man, and I can find this and read it to you, and I will sometime. He said, he talked about how foolish people go out and spend money on drink and entertainment and in bad company, and how the wise people take their money and they save it and they invest it in their business and they work hard. And it's a good advice today. If you're spending your money, you're going to be poor. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, because I want to tell you another secret. Money does not solve financial problems. And if that seems foolish to you, look at the real world. People win the lottery. They'll win $20 million, and 5 years later, they're poor again. They don't have a penny in their pocket because they spent it. That poor is a lifestyle. And I'm going to tell you that there are people, okay, let's say you make $25,000 a year, and you're poor because you can't pay your bills and you're in debt. There are people with $25 million a year who can't pay their bills and are in debt. Look, Bernie Madoff, he lost everything. He was in debt, paid bills. Some of the richest people in the world that will have $1 billion, they have bills and they're in debt. You see, they have, rich people can have the same problems as poor people if they don't use their money wisely. You know, it's just that poor people will buy cable TV, they'll buy a car, they'll buy a boat, they'll extend their credit cards. Rich people buy mansions, property in Costa Rica, bigger boats, more expensive clothes, more expensive shoes, and put, you know, more credit. As long as you're spending money instead of investing money, buying assets, you're going to be poor. And I'm going to tell you, if you look in the Buddhist literature, he says exactly the same thing. Now, there are rich people who are crooked. There are rich people that are crooked, but rich people don't victimize the poor. They do not victimize the poor. The poor are not oppressed by the rich. And you may hate me for saying this. And I'm going to tell you that people think, we're going to put someone in office to correct this. You know, this has been done before. Do you know there was no income tax before 1933? And in 1933, the lower class voted income tax, and only the rich people paid it. Middle and lower class people did not pay it. Only the rich people paid it. Well, the government liked it, so they started taxing the middle class and then the poor people. Well, the people with a lot of money who were paying most of the income tax, and they did, they were taxed more, have a lot of influence. People with a lot of money have a lot of influence, and that's the way it's always going to be. They started fighting back, and they changed laws. There are loopholes in real estate and investment where you don't pay tax. Rich people don't pay as much tax as we do on things. There are real estate transactions where you don't pay tax. There are investment transactions where you don't pay tax. So you get to keep a lot of your money. And middle class and poor pay a lot of tax. Rich people don't pay as much tax. You think it's crooked? Then what are you going to do about it? Become rich. That's your only option. Become rich and take advantage of it, because put Bernie Sanders in office. Go ahead. He can make these changes. The rich people will figure out a way to beat it. This is the reality of the world. And, you know, I'm really sorry, but you can bitch about it all you want. Any change that's going to be made is going to be temporary, because it's been done before. And you may not like what I'm saying to you, but this is the way the world works. It was the same in Jesus' time. Remember, why are you letting that woman waste that perfume? We could have sold it and given it to the poor. And Jesus said, there's always going to be poor. You can't save the poor from their lot. Jesus Christ said this. And, you know, and he's right. Not because we're non-compassionate, but because being poor is a decision and it's a lifestyle. And, you know, if you're really poor right now, and if you're struggling to pay your bills, and I'm saying this and it's making you mad, good. Do something about it. Change the way you think about money. Change the way you think about money. When you get money, don't spend it. Find a way to make that money go to work for you, because money is not real. Money is not something we dig out of the ground. It's not gold you dig out of the ground. Money is just an idea. Money does not really exist. It's an idea. And it's an idea, and you can take ideas and put them to work for you. I'm telling you this as fact. I have been broke a lot of times. I have been rich a lot of times. And I've been broke a lot of times, but I've never been poor. We're going to go to station identification, and we're going to come right back.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
I was just ranting about right profession and right livelihood and how it's no sin to be rich. It's only a sin to be rich if you hurt people. And how money is a concept and how concept is infinite, idea is infinite, thought is infinite, and how if you spend money, you're going to be poor. If you invest money, you're going to be rich. If you take your money and make it work for you, you can be prosperous, and you can be happily prosperous. And prosperity is something that is shared. We talk about cooperation and interdependency a lot in Dharma, and the commentators illustrate the interdependence of various factors in living with a very simple simile. Three boys go into a park to play, and while walking along, they see a tree with flowering tops, and they decide they want to gather those flowers. But the flowers are beyond the reach of even the tallest of the three boys, so one of the friends bends down and offers his back, and the tall boy climbs up, but he can't reach the flowers from fear of falling. So the third boy comes over and offers his shoulder for support. So the first boy, standing on the back of the second boy, leans on the shoulder of the third boy, reaches up and gathers the flowers. And this is used a lot as a simile for interdependence. No one of the boys could get those flowers. Working together, though, providing a base, providing a support, and providing a stand could do it. And in our next step, right effort, the tall boy who picks the flowers represents concentration, the with its function of unifying the mind. But to unify the mind needs support, which is the energy provided by right effort, which is like the boy who offers his back. But it also requires the stabilizing awareness provided by mindfulness, which is like the boy who offers his shoulder. So when right concentration receives the support and is then empowered by right effort and balanced by right mindfulness, it can draw in the scattered strands of thought of the mind, which is like the flowers, and fix the mind firmly on the object. This is used a lot. So this idea of unification applies to everything. Prosperity cannot be achieved alone. Poverty is usually achieved alone. Usually you're poor because you're in fear. You're afraid that if you don't hold on to your money, you're going to lose it. That's where poverty occurs. You have money, I got to hold on to this, I'm going to lose it. But what usually happens then is that you do lose it because you're going to spend it. You're going to gather things. And man, don't we have too many things to gather. You know, a house is not an asset because it costs you money. A car is not an asset because it costs you money. And the only way a house is an asset is if you're renting it and it's putting money in your pocket. You know, we're taught that a house is an asset, but is it putting money in your pocket, or are you putting money into the house? Is it taking money out of your pocket? You see, we're not taught how to think about these things. A change of thought is necessary. Poverty is usually achieved in isolation. We're not interdependent. So we're looking at right effort at this point, and the purification of conduct in this particular step of the path is established by the three factors which serves as the basis for the division of this path: concentration, which advances from moral restraint from the previous path to direct mental training. And you got to have the right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So we get this name of right effort from the goal to which it aspires, the power of sustained concentration, which is required as the support for insight wisdom. And wisdom is the primary tool for deliverance of this from this mess we're in. But the penetrating vision that is developed can only open up when the mind has been composed and collected. Fear will destroy this. Right concentration brings the requisite stillness to the mind by unifying it with the undistracted focus on a suitable object. And to do this, though, the factor of concentration has to have the aid of effort and mindfulness. You see, it's got to have all three. And right effort provides this energy demanded by the task, which is right mindfulness, which is the steadying point of awareness. So we have that simile of the three boys. One provides the base, the other provides the stabilization, and the other reaches for the flowers, which, of course, is our scattered thoughts and our monkey mind that just goes all over the place. So energy, which you'll read this sometimes if you read some of the text, they don't give you the translation, but it's called Viraya, V-I-R-I-I-Y-A, Viraya. Energy is the mental factor behind right effort. And this can appear in either wholesome or unwholesome forms, like everything else. So the same factor that fuels our desire and our aggression, our hate, our violence, and that greedy ambition on the one hand, also fuels generosity and self-discipline and kindness and compassion and concentration and understanding on the other. It's the same fuel. So the exertion involved in right effort is a wholesome form of energy, but it's something more specific. It's the energy and wholesome states of consciousness directed to the whole idea of liberation from suffering. So this last qualifying phrase is especially important. Wholesome energy, to become a contributor to the path, it has to be guided by right view and right intention, which we discussed before, and to work in association with the other path factors. Otherwise, the energy and ordinary wholesome states of mind, it just engenders an accumulation of merit that ripens within the round of birth and death. And merit's a good thing, but merit will not, by itself, will not issue liberation from the round of samsara. So time and time again, Buddha stresses this point. He stresses this need for effort, for diligence, diligent effort, exertion, and unflagging perseverance. Persevere, pursue liberation with diligence with effort. And the reason why effort is so crucial is that every person has to work out his or own deliverance. In Buddhism, there's no deliverance from an outside source. The Buddha says, don't look to me for your deliverance. I'm not going to give it to you. You have to work it out for yourself. So the Buddha does what he can by pointing out the path to liberation. He says, here's how you do it. Here's what you do. I've done it. So can you. The rest involves putting the path into practice. And it is practice. It's like learning to play the piano, learning to juggle, learning to sing. It's a task that demands energy and perseverance. Now, some people are better at this than others. It's just like doing math or drawing or, you know, playing the banjo. Some people are better than others. Some people go to this like their head's on fire, their take to it. Some people, it's a lot harder. A lot of people believe that the reason this is because of past life experience. The longer you've been at it in past lives, the better you get at it in this life. I don't know. I can't tell you from direct experience. Like I said, for me, it was like coming home. I said, hey, this sounds familiar. But the energy has to be applied to the cultivation of the mind, which forms the focus of the entire path. This is not physical training. This is mental training. And the starting point is the defiled mind. And that's the beautiful thing. You don't start out with a pure mind. You don't start out in a pure state. The starting point is the afflicted and deluded mind. And by studying the afflictions and the delusions, the goal is the liberated mind, purified and illuminated by wisdom. One by one, you go through your delusions and your afflictions, and everything is causing suffering, and you study them, and you say, what is the opposite state? And what comes in between is this perseverance to transform the defiled mind states into the liberated mind state. And this work of self-cultivation is not easy. There's no one who can do it for us but ourselves, but it's far from impossible. It's far from impossible. The Buddha himself and his disciples did it, and they provide the living proof that they did it, and lots and lots and lots and countless people before, after him, to this day, have done it and are doing it. And this gives us reassurance that this is not a myth. It's not fantasy. It's not vaporware. It's not something you read in a book that happened a million years ago. It's something that can be done. And this is an assurance that anyone who follows this path can accomplish the same goal. And I'm going to give you some, next week I'll give you some people and some places you can go look and read about people who've done it. Well, Jiddu Krishnamurti describes his liberation when he was a young man. He describes it in the middle of the night. He woke up and his mind went, and you know, he went over the brim. But they all assure us that anyone who does this can accomplish the same goal. But what's needed is that effort. It doesn't happen to you. Like puberty, you know, one day you wake up and you know your voice, you're talking like this, and then your voice cracks, and all of a sudden you talk like this, and you have, you know, hair in places you didn't have hair. It's not like puberty. It doesn't happen on its own. But they say effort and the work of practice and determination and perseverance, and this voice in you says, I will not give up these efforts until I've attained whatever is attainable by perseverance, energy, and endeavor. So we do have steps, again, laid out very logically. There's a division of right effort into four great endeavors, capital G, capital E. One, to prevent the arising of an unrisen, unwholesome states. Two, to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. Three, to arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And four, to maintain and perfect wholesome states already arisen. So these unwholesome states, which are called akusala dharma, are the defilements and the thoughts and emotions and intentions that come up, whether breaking forth into action or remaining confined within the mind. These wholesome states, which are kusala dharma, are states of mind untainted by defilements, especially those conducive to deliverance. And each of these two kinds of mental states impose a double task. It's like two sides of a coin. The unwholesome side requires that these defilements lying dormant be prevented from ever showing their ugly head, and that the active defilements already present be expelled. Kick them out. The wholesome side requires that the undeveloped liberating factors first be brought into being, then persistently developed to the point of full maturity. Now, each of these four divisions of right effort must be examined carefully. This, see, don't you love the Theravadan way of doing things? Let's examine everything carefully and beat it to death in an obsessive attention to detail. One, and we only have a few minutes, but how do you prevent the arising of unarisen and unwholesome states? The Buddha said, "Herein the disciple rouses his will to avoid the arising of evil and unwholesome states that have not yet arisen, and he makes effort, stirs up his energy, exerts his mind, and strives." That's what the Buddha said, probably just like that too. The first side of right effort aims at overcoming unwholesome states. Insofar as these states impede concentration, the defilements are usually presented in a fivefold set called the five hindrances, and they are sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And these are, as we talked about a little while back, chetasikas. Those are some of the 52 chetasikas. And they receive the name hindrances because they block your path to liberation. They're potholes in the road. And they grow up and over the mind like weeds, and they prevent calm and insight. And calm and insight are the primary two ingredients for progress. And the first two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will, are the strongest of the set, and they're the hardest fetters to break. They are formidable barriers to meditative growth, representing the unwholesome roots of greed and aversion. This is good stuff I'm giving you now here at this last couple minutes. The other three hindrances are less toxic, but they're still obstructive. These are offshoots of delusion, of ignorance, usually in association with other defilements. They rise up with the cittas, like all chetasikas, clinging to them like barnacles. Not quite as toxic, but still very obstructive. Sensual desire is interpreted in many ways, usually two. Sometimes it's understood in a narrow sense as lust for the five strands of sense pleasure, which is agreeable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. Sometimes a more broader interpretation is given, by which the term becomes inclusive in craving in all of its modes, whether for sense pleasures, wealth, power, position, fame, anything else the mind can grasp in its infinite variety of worldly pleasures. The second hindrance, ill will, is a synonym for aversion. It means hatred, anger, resentment, repulsion, shade. Whether directed toward other people, toward yourself, toward objects, toward situations, anything the mind can come up with. The third hindrance, dullness and drowsiness, is two factors linked together. Mental heaviness. One is dullness, which is inertia, mental inertia. The other is drowsiness, which is mental sinking, heaviness of mind, excessive inclination to sleep, laziness. And at the opposite extreme is restlessness and worry, which is anxiety, basically, and it's disquietude, mental disquietude, agitation, excitement, which drives the mind into a frenzy of activity, obsessive thought, worry, which is remorse, basically, over past mistakes and anxiety about their consequences, and doubt, which is a chronic indecisiveness and lack of resolution. Not critical intelligence, but indecisiveness and lack of resolution, like, I'm not sure this is going to ever work. And that's a persistent inability to commit yourself to a course of action. We'll pick this up again next week, and we'll talk more about right effort and what to do about it. Thanks for sticking with me this this week. We're now coming up next with In the Streets of Beverly Smith, and we have a link here for you. www.blogtalk LMCradio.com, LMC Radio Network, in the streets of Beverly Smith. Do stay tuned, and thank you very much for tuning in.